Yo, long hairs, welcome to episode 131 of Let It Ride. Here we talk long hair, business, advocate for hair equality, and celebrate men's long manes with hair whips and high fives. If you're a guy with long hair, you're in the right place. I'm El Sicario, warehouse manager of the long hairs, joined by El Garvinsky, our media producer. Our guest today is a man of many disciplines, a former Navy corpsman, a surfing San Diego native, a certified jiu-jitsu assassin, a father, a husband, and an all-around cool dude. Please welcome Chris Lucas.
All right.
Hey, what's up, dude?
Thank you for having me. Mahalo.
All right, man.
Mahalo.
Yeah. You know what's interesting is we connected recently.
Yeah.
Like, we haven't, you know, and I kind of like, we obviously established like you were going to be on the show instantly.
Yeah.
But I kind of refrained from diving too much into like getting like it was weird because I'm like a kind of person, if I like you, like I'm all in. I want to be friends and I want to know everything.
Yeah.
But I was like, you know what, like this guy's pretty cool. I feel like I should get to know you as at the same time that like our viewers and listeners are getting to know you.
Right on.
So I've resisted the urge to hit you up and just be like, hey dude, like what's this about, what's, you know, hey let's go hang out or whatever.
Yeah, it's all good, man. Likewise, the same. I mean, yeah. It's cool, like, because when you meet people, like, there's an instant vibe, instant connection. You can say, like, hey, man, like, this dude is cool. He gets it.
Yeah.
He knows what's up. You know what I mean? I'm the same way. I don't know if they call that an empath or not, but, yeah.
Yeah, dude. You know what it is? It's that. I think it's, like, you feel, like, you know when you're around someone and you can just almost feel, like, this is a cool dude or a cool
person. Yeah, you can feel the energy.
And it's, like, I'm like the little puppy that follows you home, like, this guy's awesome. I want to know that guy.
I don't think I'm that awesome, but man, like I appreciate you guys like just saying like, oh, okay, he's kind of a cool guy. Like let's talk to this guy.
Yeah. So you contacted us, right?
Correct.
And that was just kind of like we started chatting. And
yeah. I mean, lifestyle, right? Guys with long hair.
Uh huh.
It's kind of a rarity nowadays, I think. Mm-hmm. Right. Everyone's really corporate and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's definitely like a niche.
Yeah, totally.
Most people are definitely still like short hair.
So when this came up on my Instagram feed, I said, whoa, like we have something in common.
Right.
And it's a difficult kind of club to enter in, A, because you have to grow your hair and that's time consuming. Mm-hmm. And B, it's like usually guys with long hair have like just kind of a different lifestyle, right? And there's something there. There's a culture. And when I saw that on Instagram, I was like, whoa, okay, like I can connect with these guys. And lo and behold, I didn't know you guys were here in San Diego.
Right.
So that tripped me out. I was like, oh, wait, you guys are from San Diego. And I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. And then like you invited me and I was like, okay, I'll check it out. And so again, cool, instant connections.
And right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause, and then I, cause you know, we get a bunch of DMs like every day.
Yeah.
And of course, like my contribution to the social media department is I do a lot of the engagement. So I'll respond to DMs, I'll leave comments, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so I saw your DM and I was like, oh, this is like an interesting, and like for some people, you know, like your profile pic is like, you have the helmet with like the nods and all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously for someone like me, like I instantly knew what that was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, cause I feel it's weird. Not a lot of vets. Like, a lot of vets won't keep, like, grooming standards, of course,
but
they still kind of stick with the short hair.
Yeah.
And then, even when I go to, like, veteran, like, charity events or stuff, like, I'm always typically, like, the only dude that I see with long hair.
Yeah.
And even, like, my own kind, like, the vets will look at me like, what's your deal, dude?
Yeah.
So when I saw, I was like, oh, this guy's, like, a vet and has long hair, like that's interesting. Like,
yeah.
And then,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of went from there.
So, little background about myself.
For sure.
I was in the Navy for 11 years. I was an FMF corpsman, did 2 combat deployments to Iraq. And it was getting kind of rough, man, like towards the end. I was going to apply for a commission as a Lieutenant JG since I had my first master's degree.
Uh huh.
And I just felt it was time. You know what I mean?
Like
it was time for
on.
Me to go. Yeah.
Yeah.
That plus the fact that I think that they were starting to deploy corpsmen with the U.S. Army. I don't know if you knew that. Yeah.
I didn't know
that. Yeah. They were losing a lot of their medics. So they were starting to task us to start deploying with them. And as you know, like, you know, typical Navy Marine Corps deployment, about, what, 7-8 months, that normal float.
But those Army deployments hit different.
15
dude.
Months, yeah, bro, yikes. In country. And then you get, like, this 2-week R&R, but then it's like, whoa, you gotta go back. It's just like, dude, that's like, you know, okay. So anyways, I was just like, you know what, like, it's cool and everything, and, you know, I got all this education, I got all this stuff out of it, but I just felt like I wasn't brainwashed, for lack of a better term.
And institutionalized,
yeah, there you go, even better. So the thing is I grew up here in San Diego, and I was stationed here for 10 out of the 11 years that I was in the Navy.
Right.
So for me, it was like, oh, okay, well, I'm back home, and I just go to work and do my job, but I'm wearing a uniform, but I still got to kick it with all my homies, you know, still be on the block or whatever, and you know what I mean? Nothing illicit or crazy, but still, you know, I get to, you know, be with my homies. You know, as opposed to, you get guys that come from, like, Midwest or the East Coast, and they come to San Diego, and they're like, whoa, like, you know, surf's up, and, like, they don't know any better, but that clique of people, like, right. in the military.
Yeah.
And obviously, they don't know any better. So I remember when I was in school at Naval Hospital, guys wanted to go down to TJ to party, and I'm like, bro, like, do you not understand?
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah. Number one, you got the high and tight, man. You're going to get picked out of the crowd super quick. But yeah. Number two, it's like, you know, I grew up here, and I rarely go down there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, same.
Yeah. And
yeah, I think there's something about guys that join the military that are from, let's say, places that are not as, like, cultured or not. That's not true, because they have their own culture where they're from. Let's say diverse.
Correct.
Right. They may not have a lot of exposure to things outside of
their bubble,
their own culture, their right. own hub. Right.
Right. Right.
And so the military becomes their identity.
Correct.
Right. And what I've noticed is, especially all the vets that I know from where I'm from, which right. is here. It was kind of like, yeah, I'm proud of having served, but it wasn't, it's not the only thing about me.
Yeah.
There's so many other things. And I think it has something to do with being exposed to, like, so many walks of life.
Yeah.
And just understanding that there's so many iterations of, there's, like, so many versions of you that you could be.
Right. Yeah.
And not just be the military guy.
Yeah.
And I know, so I got out in 2013.
Okay.
And it's interesting because I don't even know why I got out.
Interesting, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I do know that, so I did two deployments. My second one was in 2012, which was during the drawdown.
Okay.
And it was not good. Just, it was like, I'm not trying to make, like, a political statement, but
of course.
It was not handled well, right. I think. And so there were, like, assets that we didn't have. And
correct.
It's like things got really rough, dude, like really dangerous, and we had a KIA of a guy that I was with Second Recon. He wasn't in our unit, but he was attached to our unit as a tanker, and he passed. And that really, like, that changed my whole mindset of the military. And it wasn't my first KIA experience, but it was just different. Like, I was just different after that. Like, I didn't and then I remember finding out that, like, that's it, there weren't any more Recon Marines going to Afghanistan. So I said, like, well, where are we going? And they're like, that's we're not deploying anywhere.
Really?
Like, you might go on a MEU. So for those of you that don't know, a MEU is when you see the big carrier sailing to wherever.
Right.
There's a lot of sailors, but there's also a lot of Marines in that giant ship, that floating, you know, airport.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want to go do that. Right. To me, it's like, what am I destroying my body for?
Yeah.
If not to go to war, well, I don't want to wreck myself just to pretend.
Right. Yeah.
And so that was kind of like, I guess, the catalyst for me getting out. But then once I got out, I was like, well, I could have done something else.
Yeah.
I got the MARSOC recruiting email.
Yeah.
And that was, like, right before I got out. It even said, like, I can see you're getting out. How about come talk to me instead?
Really? Yeah.
And I knew, like, dude, if I go down there, that's it.
Yeah.
I'm not getting out. I'm not going home, because I was stationed in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not going home. If I know if I go down there, that guy's going to talk me into staying.
Yeah.
And I in my mind I had committed. But what's interesting is I didn't even know what I was getting out to do,
yeah,
or like who I was going to be or what I was, you know, anything.
Yeah.
And I think that actually contributed to why I had such a hard time after I got out. But it's just interesting. And I think going back to our original point was I was from a place where there's just so many different people. And in my mind, it was like, I don't need to be this person.
Yeah.
I love that I was this person, but I want this to just be one of the chapters, not the only chapter of my life.
Yeah.
And so I decided to seek my fortune elsewhere.
Some people can't separate that. I think that they had this identity crisis where they think, like, that's it, man. That was my pinnacle. That's what I am. That's what I'm always going to be. And yeah, that's cool. Like, I get it. You know what I mean? But that literally to me was just a chapter in my life, man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A good chapter, but it was a chapter in the book of life for me.
Yeah, it's definitely very prevalent in the veteran community.
Yeah.
But I think it's, you know, just like the guys that still wear their Letterman jacket when they're 30.
Yeah.
Right? It's like
the Al Bundys.
You know, like, oh, I was, you know, state champion. I threw 13 touchdowns.
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know shit about football, but.
Yeah.
But the point is, like, you had this achievement early on in your life.
Yeah.
And it's almost like sold to you. Like, you're indoctrinated to believe this is it.
Yes.
This is as good as it will get. And so everything else forever will pale in comparison. And so for some guys, that is their identity.
Yeah.
It's like, I, you know, like, I was in the Marine Corps, right? So, like, I got my Eagle, Globe, and Anchor, and that's it. Like,
yeah,
nothing else matters.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's so many things that I could do and so many things I have done.
Yeah.
And, but then you have the guys that are like, that's it. I don't care. Like, to this day, it's like, you know, you've been out for 15 years, and I know guys like this, you've been out for 15 years, have accomplished nothing.
Yeah.
But doesn't matter, because for 4 years of my life, ending 15 years ago,
yeah,
I did this thing.
Yeah.
It's like, be proud of that, dude, but find new things to be proud of.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
I mean, you can't rest on your laurels, you know what I mean? Yeah. I think also when it comes to that, I do see like how the military is somewhat changing in terms of how they operate and how they're doing things, for better or for worse. You know, that's for somebody else to decide. But I believe now, what I see, it's becoming very corporate.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's a good mix when you have a corporate ideology in the military, which is an institution that's been that way for 200 plus years.
Yeah. I see. Yeah.
You know, and yeah, so it's an interesting thing to think about. I do have friends that were, well, actually one just retired last Monday.
Oh, wow.
Senior Chief Bush. Yeah. Good friend of mine. I was in Iraq with him first time during the invasion on OIF-1. But like, I'm in that, and it's crazy because like for me, I look kind of young. I kind of want to say that, but you know, truth be told, I originally thought I was turning 47. I'm actually turning 46, and people like trip out because when they see me, they're like, you know, usually if I talk to people, I'm like, oh yeah, well, my son, and they was, how old is your son? Oh, he's 23. 23? Like, how old are you? I thought you were like, so I was like, nah, you know, I had my son when I was 21.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I felt it was a good time to have a kid. But that might be just military culture, where you have kids young.
Yeah.
And, you know, you go from there. And my wife and I just, you know, decided to have one child. And yeah, he's pretty rad because my wife and I had put 100% of raising him correctly with, you know, correct etiquette, you know, just normal, simple things that you would think that are normal, but, you know, to other people, it can be abnormal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that we're talking about this because I just had a patient yesterday tell me, wow, you're very courteous and you're nice and I like your energy and you're very polite. And I was like, well, this is just normally how I am. Like, have you had other experiences at different places or like what? Like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that to me, that's inherent. And, you know, I guess it's a learned trait from our parents or, you know, our families and loved ones. Right. So,
yeah. Okay. So walk me through. So you joined in 1997.
Correct.
which, by the way, I was, depending on the month, I was either 6 or 7 years old.
Holy shit.
Yeah. okay, so why the military? Why? Because this is peacetime.
Okay, so originally, sound kind of weird. Well, I don't want to toot my own horn. So originally, I was supposed to graduate high school in 96, but I skipped a grade. So technically graduated class in 95, went to Montgomery High School down South Bay. And I tried my luck in college, and I was like, man, I don't know if I'm digging this, man. Like, you know what I mean? It's just not me. I wasn't feeling it. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do something, you know, that was like I could get paid to do, mm-hmm. you know? And so as a young guy, you're like, oh, I want to be a SEAL or, you know, something cool like that. Right. So, you know, went down to talk to the recruiter and everything like that. And he's like, oh, well, there's this thing. It's called a corpsman. I was like, what is a corpsman?
Yeah.
I was like, yes. And, you know, he explained it. And he's like, but you can do work in a hospital or you can go with the Marines. I was like, you know what? Yeah. And then you get weapons training and stuff like that. I was like, all right, cool.
Yeah.
Like, you know what? I'll sign up and do that. Like, oh, but the caveat, you know, it's a year waiting list. And I was like, all right, cool, whatever, man. So signed up and just did my thing, you know what I mean? But in the interim, you know, I'm hanging out with all my buddies and stuff still on the block. And, you know, thank God I didn't get caught up doing anything stupid with those guys. Because, you know, as kids, you know, you do stupid stuff, especially growing up here in San Diego. You know, there's a lot of crime that can be occurred.
Yeah, there was a lot more violence back then.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was like so the 90s, like, right? That was like the era of like gangster rap. That was like when it was at its height. Yeah.
And like that was a time when like the cartels were like recruiting.
Oh, yeah.
From like certain neighborhoods,
yeah.
and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, and so there was like pretty serious violence.
Yeah.
That was like kind of towards the back end of it, but it was still out there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It kind of got, I think I remember over here, remember there was a thing that happened at Logan Heights, or no, there was guys from Logan. They shot and killed like some cardinal down in TJ because they thought it was like some other like crazy, like,
yeah, it was a crazy time.
Yeah, man. There was a crazy time.
Okay, so you did the delayed entry.
Yeah.
And then but obviously you got in.
Yeah.
And you did the whole, you know, what is, first of all, I'm such a, I don't, I, dude, I have no, what is Navy basic training called? It's not called boot camp, right?
Yeah, it is actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. And then I don't know any of this.
Everyone else refers to it as basic.
Okay. Well, that makes more sense.
Yeah, but we're, yeah, boot camp.
Okay.
Which was kind of a joke.
okay, so then you did the whole basic training thing.
Yeah.
You go to Corpsman school.
A school. Yeah,
in
Great Lakes.
Right.
And so that also, now that took like another 6 months to class up. So we're like in this TPU, which is like temporary hold. And basically you're just,
oh yeah, you just like don't exist.
Yeah, and you're cleaning and you're shining the bright works. Like never in my life, dude.
Chipping gum off the sidewalk.
I'm just like, man, like this is for the birds, dude.
Yeah,
like, but at least I got to work out like every day, you know,
right.
Get in shape and stuff like that. I think ultimately my plan was try to be a SEAL.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was like my goal.
For sure.
Right. So come out of boot camp and next thing you know, I was with my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, for maybe a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, like when you're in basic and you got a lot of time to think, man, a lot of downtime, especially when you're laying in your rack. And I was like, man, I think this is the woman. I need to marry this woman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't let her go.
For sure.
So I wrote her a letter and I said, look, hey, I'm going to come back from boot camp. Let's get married. And she just said, yeah. And I said, okay, cool. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
We got married, and dude, been married for 25 years now.
Wow.
Sweet. Yeah.
Amazing, man.
Yeah, it's been a long time, but yeah, so we, yeah, you know, not dude. To digress off of the
yeah.
military
but
service.
I'd like to butt in real quick.
Yeah.
That is remarkable considering the divorce rate, especially
yeah.
for junior enlisted
oh, yeah.
service members, is like crazy
yeah.
high.
Well,
like the odds were really against you guys.
Stacked, yeah. yeah. Well, I think to my wife's credit, her brother was a Marine officer,
uh-huh.
Mustang, which if you don't know means that they were enlisted first and then got commissioned later.
Right.
As well as her father. Her father was a Mustang as well.
Oh, wow.
So she already had that lifestyle. Like, mm-hmm. She knew.
She kind of knew the life.
Yeah,
her,
yeah. And it was all good because right. They took care of her. And yeah, and I'm thankful for my brother-in-law and my father-in-law for doing that when I was gone, you know, mm-hmm. deployed and stuff like that. But yeah, so Navy training, did that, did my basic corpsman school. I think it was like 8 or 9 months. And then I went to Pendleton right after. Now mm-hmm. I went to field medical school. I forgot mm-hmm. what they call it now, but basically it's just, hey, like if you want to be operational with Marine Corps, you have to do this. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, I want to do that. And by the way, that training was harder than Navy boot camp.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Because Navy boot camp was just the equalizer. Well, dude, like if you really wanted to get down with Marine Corps, you had to go through that training.
Yeah. Cause you're training at the Marine Corps standard now.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And once the standard's elevated, now you have to step up to the plate. Otherwise right. you're not going to be able to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after, you know, I did that, field training, field med school, and then I got first duty station Miramar, which was the transition from NAS to MCAS. And so I was part of that working party that went to El Toro to bring all that stuff down. Yeah. Cause you know, I was like an E2 or E3 at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Slow ranking guy and like, all right, yeah, I'll go down, we'll go over there and do all that stuff.
So you were in the, so what happens is after you get through all your training, your like basic entry level training, you get to what's called the fleet,
correct.
Which is now like the general body of, in this case, the Navy, but yes. the Marine Corps also calls it the fleet.
Yes.
So you get, so like you do all your basic training and now you're like a fully operational, ready to go with the bow on top.
Yeah.
Like ready to go corpsman, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You get to the fleet, which is the general Navy, but you're attached to a Marine Corps unit.
Correct.
And what year is that when you're done, when you're finally like in the fleet?
I say 99 or 2000.
So you had at least a full year.
Yeah.
I mean, almost pretty less, like nearly 2 full years.
Yeah.
Before 9/11.
Yeah. Yeah. And 9/11, man. That's a watershed moment that everyone remembers where
everyone.
They're at.
I remember.
I was the duty NCO. 22 area Camp Pendleton. Uh-huh. And for those of you who don't know, the duty NCO is you sit there and you log people in and out that come into the barracks and you make sure there's no tomfoolery or weird stuff going on. And that's basically what you do for 24 hours. And I was like, man, I don't even live in this barracks, dude. Like I have a house in Chula Vista. Like here I am.
Right? You're there to make sure like nobody's setting fires.
Right. And yeah. Right.
Drunken battles in the courtyard.
Right.
And
so yeah. As I was sitting there, I don't remember. It was like 5:30, 6 in the morning. Coffee. You know, I'm doing my last entries. You know, and CNN's on in the background in the lounge, and all of a sudden it just starts going down. And you're like,
wow.
You see it, and you're like, at first I thought, well, it looks just like a Cessna or a tiny plane.
Like an accident. Like yeah. I think everyone thought that.
That's
like
what everyone, yeah.
There's like some kind of freak accident happened.
Yeah, and then it just started going down.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a call from the first sergeant. He's like, hey, everyone, tomorrow, inspection, everything on the grinder, which for everyone knows like this big parade field. Got to put all the gear you've been issued.
So the grinder is essentially like, it looks to someone that doesn't understand, it would look like a big parking lot without any stalls painted on it. And it's like traditionally where Marines would practice like drill, or otherwise you see them in like their parade formation or whatever. But in this case, it's like what he's saying is that his key leadership was like, hey, go grab all your issued gear and you're going to lay it out on the asphalt so that we can inspect that you have everything you need, which is typically happens for like a handful of reasons.
Yeah.
In this case, it's like a hint like, hey, we might actually be going to war now.
Yeah.
So we need to see that everybody has their gear.
Yep.
Right?
Yep, that's exactly it.
And so what do you remember? Cause when this happens, dude, so I'm I was born September 19, 1990.
Okay.
So I was 10.
Okay.
And I remember I have my own, like, where was I 9/11, but it doesn't matter. I was like in, I don't know, fifth or sixth grade in 2001. And for me, the military was still, you know, 8 years away.
Yeah.
You're a guy that was in the military and you were there before, like I guess what I'm trying to say is I joined knowing and desiring to go fight, knowing I was going to go fight, because it had already been years by the time I, you know, then like we went to Afghanistan within 2 weeks of 9/11, and Iraq was already 6 years deep by the time I joined. Right.
Yeah.
So I had no illusions of what I was going to be doing.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted.
Yeah.
But for you, it was different.
Yeah.
So do you remember a clear moment where it was like, it's happening?
I think the drive home, when I left, right after 9/11, we got the call from the first sergeant, tomorrow there's a gear inspection at 0600 on the grinder.
Mm-hmm.
And literally the drive home and like the feeling of, where's all my stuff in this garage?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I got to scramble. Even those tent stakes, those orange tent stakes, man. Like, all that stuff I had. I mean, it was my gear bag.
All the little pieces of kit that you got issued that you're like, I'm never going to use this in a million years.
Yeah.
Especially at this time. Because you had no... Obviously, you knew you're in the military. Your job is to go fight if there is a fight.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, we'd had, like, Beirut and little mini engagements.
Yeah.
But... at this point, there's like nothing going on.
Yeah.
And so as far as you're concerned, like you can't even conceive at this moment that there's going to be like a war.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it's fun to, you know, run around and jump and shoot things.
And like train.
But people that aren't shooting back. But
you're shooting at paper targets. Yeah.
Yeah. Once rounds come down range, you're like, okay, like it's real.
Yeah.
I remember the OIF deployment, OIF-1, for those that you don't know, is Operation Iraqi Freedom, but it was the initial invasion in 2003. I was there. And I remember as the invasion started, we're going forward and we're going to go do this and that. And then the Jessica Lynch thing had happened.
Mm.
Now, I was attached to a medical battalion that was taking casualties.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first experience in seeing like actual death and dismemberment and stuff mm-hmm. like that. But I remember hearing the Jessica Lynch thing. Now they got ambushed and we had taken either one or two of those army soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And what they had done was they were telling this crazy story about how they were ambushed. They thought they were Americans because the Saddam Fedayeen, which was basically Saddam's personal bodyguards,
mm-hmm.
they dressed, this is what I remember hearing that. They dressed in American uniforms and they were telling this convoy, go down this street. And as soon as they went down that street, they got lit up. So when we heard that, we were like, whoa, what is this? Saddam Fedayeen? Like, who are these guys?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was like a kind of like a thing where it was like, all right, like maybe these guys, we're not going to like steamroll these guys. Like, you know?
Yeah, because what's interesting is when in OIF-1, you weren't fighting against insurgents.
Yeah, it was the...
initially.
Yeah, the uniformed army.
It was
yeah.
like the actual Afghani... or no, excuse me, sorry.
The Iraqi army. Yeah, yeah.
That in itself... we've both been to war, right?
Yeah.
But like, that's something I can't even conceive of because I never saw... the only uniforms I ever saw were like Afghani army guys, but they were like supposedly on our side. Our side,
yeah. Yeah.
But like, you were actually fighting guys in uniforms.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah, you know, it's weird now, like with especially how warfare is being conducted now, where it just seems, well, other than what's going on with the whole Ukraine-Russia thing,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, everyone's wearing multicam and then mm-hmm. they basically put tape on it. Like,
they have to wear tape so they can tell each other. Yeah,
that's a weird concept that they're doing that. But I understand what you're saying. You're fighting a uniformed combatant.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know, maybe in Vietnam they... not really. Maybe the NVA did, right?
Well, yeah, the NVA did, but even then they still had the Viet Cong to deal with. Yeah, which
was straight guerrilla warfare.
But and I think even a lot of them had some semblance of a uniform.
Of looking, yeah. So I guess like that, I mean, that was, now that you say that, it's an interesting concept. I never really thought about that.
I mean, how many Americans, how many, let's say American combat veterans, like if you were to group everyone, how many American veterans have combat experience? It's like not a lot. It's actually like 1% or something like that.
Yeah.
But then of that 1%, how many have actually shot or been shot at by a uniform?
Yeah.
That's like so abstract at this point because
yeah.
our whole concept of warfare this many decades in is that we fight insurgents. Like, we fight guys that don't wear uniforms.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is a freaking nightmare.
I know.
I can tell you from personal experience, right?
Yeah.
But still, it's like, it's a whole nother, it's like just so interesting to me.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know? Go ahead.
No, I was going to, just to kind of go off that uniform thing. This was my second deployment to Iraq, and we had captured some, you know, insurgents. And part of what our translator was telling us, and this is no knock on the Army, because I actually did work with a 5th Special Forces group, Green Berets, which were amazing in Iraq. But the insurgent that they had captured, our translator was saying that they knew, the insurgents knew to attack the Army because they knew that uniform. They knew that weird gray digital, or they knew like the tricolor desert, which was like the old school. Like, they knew that yeah. they were National Guard, or they knew regular Army. If they saw Marines,
yeah,
the MARPAT, which is the desert digital, because only Marines and SEALs and a couple guys from Delta were wearing it, they knew not to attack those guys, but they knew what the regular Army, mm-hmm. they knew to attack them. And this is what this is what our translator told mm-hmm. us. So that was just like a mind-blowing thing. We're like, whoa, okay.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because that also happened in Sangin Valley when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally held by the British, and they got the crap kicked out of them, dude. They
really?
Yeah, it was horrifying for them.
Wow.
And then I think the Marines took it over in, I believe it was 09.
Uh-huh.
Don't quote me on that. But then First Recon was there, and they had, you know what a Mitch helmet is, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
they had the Mitch helmets.
Yeah.
That had the Rhino mount,
yeah.
or it had the diamond that you then put the Rhino mount yeah. in for your night vision.
Yeah.
And the First Recon, all their guys had the little piece, but it was black.
Okay.
So they were called the Black Diamonds.
Oh, wow.
So the Taliban called them the Black Diamonds.
Interesting.
And they literally, there's like communication of them saying on the radio, like, if you see Black Diamonds, like, don't shoot at them.
Oh,
like,
man.
You won't, you're not going to win.
Really?
Yeah. They're literally saying like, it's better just let them pass through.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a
and for
man.
Anyone that has not been to war, of course, there's no guys with AKs standing there watching you walk by and saying, like, they're saying from afar, like,
yeah,
just stay hidden and yeah. don't engage with them, because we never win against them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then First Recon left, and I was with Second Recon, so then my battalion showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had another name. I don't actually quite remember it. It has something to do with, like, at night, because we would only move at night.
Okay.
And then we would just show up. Like, we would do all our movements at night and then occupy a position, and then so that we were ready when the sun came up.
Yeah.
Which is like infantry 101. It's not like special tactics or anything.
Yeah.
So they called us a name. I can't remember. It's been like, I mean, this is 2011 for me, right?
Yeah.
But that we had our own nickname too. And then they would be like, oh, well, these guys, like, you know, don't do your best to avoid them. Like,
yeah.
It's just interesting how, like, different countries, different cultures, different times,
yeah.
and but still, like, stuff like that happens.
Yeah.
Where I think in Iraq, the Marines were called, like, Black Boots or something like that.
Oh, really?
And I don't know if it was Fallujah or, like very early on, before the desert camis and all that, like, the digital came out.
Yeah.
Like, early, because you guys had, like, tricolors, right?
Yeah, tricolor DCU. We even had a guy, he was a National or reserve guy, and uh-huh. he wore the old, like, Desert Storm chocolate chip, and because he was like a reserve guy, like, nobody ever wanted to, like, hit him up and be like, hey man, you know, that's, that uniform isn't even valid anymore.
Yeah, it's, but like, not even authorized.
We just let him do his thing, you know.
Yeah.
Like, okay, he's just a reserve guy or whatever.
Yeah, wow.
But yeah, so
that's like some Desert Storm stuff.
Yeah, Desert Storm stuff, man. And wow. Yeah, it was super, and he didn't even have name tapes or anything. He was just like, I'm just going to go to the surplus store and buy this chocolate chip uniform and just rock that. But yeah, we were wearing the tricolor DCU back then.
Like, during the initial invasion.
Yeah. Which was weird too, because, well, I don't know. This, you know how Marine Corps is, like, kind of slow to change.
Yeah.
Our flak jackets were all woodland, you know, and you could tell, because you had to wear a mop suit, because during, right when the invasion hit, and if you're not aware, a mop suit is basically a nuclear biological suit that was issued to us because we thought Saddam was going to use chemical weapons. But anyways...
Yeah, well, actually, to be more clear, it's like a jumpsuit that you get into, and then you put your gas mask on. It has a hood that goes over your head, and then you like it like cinches over your gas mask. Yeah. And so in theory,
right,
it's supposed to protect you from like a chemical attack or a biological bomb or, you know, whatever. It's,
yeah.
But I don't know if it's ever actually been tested.
Who knows,
they
man.
Say it works. So, hey, dude.
And, I know, right? Just like how the anthrax vaccine, like, oh, get the anthrax vaccine.
Oh, yeah. Like, I still have.
What you got to do? You got to do it. Yeah.
I still have mine.
I got it, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
I think this is the anthrax one, right?
Smallpox.
This is smallpox.
Oh, yeah. All I know is that they said, hey, you got to get it before you deploy.
Yeah.
And it was like, you can't hug your wife. You can't pick up your kid and kiss him or this and that. And I was like, dude, I'm just going to do this in country, man.
Yeah.
Since I was the doc, I was just like, yeah, I'll get vaccinated while I'm there, which was a mistake, man, because like here we are in the sweltering heat in Kuwait.
Yeah.
And we're like, you know, the war hadn't even started yet. And I'm like, I've got like a fever and I'm like laying in my rack. There's no AC.
Oh, that's horrible.
And yeah.
And those those Iraqi summers, especially.
Oh, man.
Dude.
Yeah. It's brutal, especially if you've got all your kit on and everything.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, man.
Yeah. I went to Iraq as a contractor.
Okay.
And man, I think the hottest day I can remember was like 125.
Yeah, it's brutal, man.
I'm pretty sure it was like 120. It was like, I'm almost certain it was 125.
Yeah, it's...
And like, dude, I was a contractor, which means I was going from air-conditioned building to air-conditioned building.
Yeah.
Right? And even then, like, just the couple minutes I was outside, I was already like feeling sick.
Yeah.
And like, dude, this is too hot.
Yeah.
Like, this is insane. And then... There were guys here years ago that there was no AC. You're in a tent and you got a fan that's just blowing more hot air on you.
Yeah, I remember we had taken over this barracks at this airbase called Al Asad, and it was kind of bombed out, but it was a barracks that was a place to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember there being a shower. There's like, you know, three or four showers there. And I was like, whoa, there's water, running water. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to take a shower, man. I hadn't showered like in 2 or 3 weeks, right? Man, I don't know what was in that water. It smelled like JP5 or jet fuel or something. But I, like, literally for like 2 or 3 minutes, I started smelling it coming from the water. And I was like, whoa, like, okay, like, this is like, what is this? So I turned it off and, you know, cleaned up really quick. And, you know, we went out and other Marines were like, dang, Doc, why are you smell like gas. What did you do? And I'm like, oh, I just tried to take a shower, man. And yeah, I don't know what.
Filled the wrong tank or something.
I have no idea, man. But yeah, that freaked me out because I smelled like gas for like a day or two.
That's, and dude, you just, all kinds of, dude, those things, you just hear so many nutty stories.
Yeah.
All the in-between moments, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Okay. So man, we could be here all day talking
about.
We should do like another. I think we can just do a whole episode on military stuff.
Yeah.
But so, okay, that's early 2000s. You do 11 years?
11, yeah.
And then, so this is now like 2009?
Yeah.
And then you get out, and then what?
So originally, like I said, I wanted to be a SEAL.
Sure.
But when you have kids and a family,
your priorities change.
Yeah. So that changed for me. So being in medicine, I said, well, I can go to these other specialty schools if I decide to get out. Again, I'm thinking of the future. You know, I'm like, hey, what am I going to do if I do get out? At least I have something to fall back on. So luckily for me, I was able to get into the radiology program that the Navy had offered.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for a year and a half and got my license and credentials and my undergraduate degree. And so I was moonlighting. So basically I was still active duty, but I was working at the civilian hospitals in the area. And I was like making connections there. And I think again, that was another catalyst that said, hey, like, you know what? You can do pretty well financially if you decide, in the event that you decide to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, with the option came that Navy was saying, hey, you're going to deploy to Afghanistan for 15 months with the U.S. Army. I'm like,
Yeah.
About that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I got out, and it was so easy, man. It was a lateral transfer right into the civilian community because mm-hmm. I already knew what I was doing.
Right.
So I had been I do ultrasound essentially.
Okay.
And I've been doing it for almost, well, it's probably greater than 20 years now.
Wow.
Yeah. And I've gotten to the point now, like I say, you know, I teach ultrasound now at UCSD.
Okay.
Over at the School of Medicine.
That's awesome, dude.
And then I'm also the clinical coordinator for UCSD's ultrasound program.
That's so, really awesome.
Yeah. So, you know, like this trajectory of like from here to there, it was really like circuitous where like it wasn't direct path. And it's just one of those things where things line up in life and things are like, okay, that door didn't open, but this one opened and I'll just go that way. And my dad he's always says, you know, I just land on my feet all the time. And like, I don't know if like I have that blessing that, you know, he has where like everything like in my way just goes my way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's just, it's an interesting thing. I don't know if they call it kismet or something with the universe listening to what your needs are. And it's like, okay, well, maybe we can do this. If that door doesn't open, then this one will open, and then you can do that.
Yeah, I'm gonna. And I have an interesting take. Or not interesting. It's not up to me to decide if it's interesting, but my take on, like, I don't think the universe listens to us.
Mm-hmm.
I think the universe is a constant,
mm-hmm.
and we're just a little speck.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that. I mean, of course, this is easy for us to say because we're not in the Congo, like, yeah. mining for cobalt, right?
Yeah.
But we are fortunate enough to be in a place where we do have opportunities.
Oh, yeah.
But I think there's that saying, luck is when preparation meets opportunity.
Yeah.
But the key there is preparation.
Yeah.
And, you know, you didn't just rely on the fact that you had achievement already. I was a corpsman, FMF corpsman, combat veteran. Like, you also continued to better yourself, right? Educate yourself, develop more skills, and you literally manifested a new opportunity out of thin air.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I mean,
like, that didn't happen to you by accident.
Yeah. Well, now that you put it in that way, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because sure, yes, like those people were there that you could moonlight for, and the education system is there for you to learn, right? To get certified and get these degrees and stuff. But had you not sought that opportunity out and had the discipline to see it through, you wouldn't be this person.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, like with your dad saying like, oh, I just always land on my feet. It's like, yeah, but I'm sure there's a degree of discipline in there and,
yeah,
you know, opting to continue to work,
yeah,
and be ready essentially and develop yourself as a man,
yeah,
right. And because like the adverse of that is the guys that woe is me and I wasn't born rich and all this stuff, and it's like, yeah, but you don't have to die poor.
Exactly.
Either, right?
That's like a thing, like especially with friends that you knew growing up, and you're, yeah, like, I want to help them because those are your homies, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's only so much you can do. I mean, I've tried to help so many of my friends, man.
Yeah. And you know, I'm sure you can relate. My two best friends, we took different directions.
Yeah.
I got out. I did like a year of nothing because I had like real bad issues with post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
And then eventually I found meaningful employment and then took all these, I just did a bunch of stuff,
yeah,
and then eventually landed here. Not landed, opted to work here.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my two best friends, they went the college route, got their degrees, and then they've, you know, built these lives for themselves.
Yeah.
But I also know guys that got out and they're in no better today than when they got out 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's really sad. I mean, that bums me out because it's like, as a human, like, you inherently want to help people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if, you know, maybe not everyone's like that, but I want to say the majority of humanity.
I would say that's the norm. We're like, we're pack animals. We're tribal creatures.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's in our DNA, the average person, it's in their, yeah, DNA to at least moderately want to assist,
help,
and be people. Part of a cohesive unit.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I mean, again, just to kind of go back to that, where you have friends that you try to help. I do have a friend that recently kind of came back into my life that literally during the COVID time had a heart transplant.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's was knocking on death's door. And if you remember during the COVID times, you could not go into a hospital unless you were absolutely sick or had COVID.
Mm-hmm. I have a story about that. Please continue.
So the only person that was able to see this guy was me, because I worked in the hospital. And I would talk to this guy every day. And I would say, hey, JP, you should come and train jiu-jitsu, man. Mm-hmm. It'll change your life. Like, it changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
It helped me out. And he had always expressed interest in doing it. I was like, hey, like, it's cool, man. Like, I'll help you through it. I'll guide you through it. And he's like, okay, you know what? I'll do it as soon as I can get better. Well, you know, the doctors had kind of given him this spiel, like, oh, you may be able to do it, like, in a couple of years. You know, make sure you're...
Like, who are you comparing me to?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this guy, he kicks ass, man.
Really?
Like, I remember, like, 3 or 4 months after he got his heart transplant, I was like, hey, let's go paddle out, man. So we drove up to Cardiff, surfed a little bit over there. He was a little winded, so I could kind of tell, like, oh, okay, it's cool, man. Well, let's go to Pizza Port in Del Mar, get a beer, and just, you know, how you feeling and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then he felt good. And so just as testament to this guy, you know, being post-transplant heart surgery, and you're like, okay, this guy's like already out there getting it again. You know, he's surfing. He's, you know, he's doing it. Now he's going to take it to the next level. So then the guy starts training jiu-jitsu with me. And this guy is there like every day. He's so dedicated to it.
Mm-hmm.
And jiu-jitsu is a pretty physical sport.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to have a lot of cardio stamina
mm-hmm.
to do it. But this guy, he went after it, man. And just 2 weeks ago, got his blue belt.
Wow.
And so, yeah, that's usually about a 1 to maybe 2 year timeline to get that. But the guy was so dedicated to it. Everyone saw it. And then again, this kind of goes to what you're saying about how we're a tribe. We're pack animals,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better term. Everyone at my gym, which is Gracie South Bay National City, no plug. everyone out, at my gym was helping this guy.
For sure.
Because everyone wanted to see him succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in life, when you surround yourself with people that want to see you succeed, you're going to succeed too.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that old saying, you surround yourself with 5 losers, I'll show you who the 6 is.
Yeah.
Well, the same can be applied to the winning faction. You have people that want to see you succeed, then we're going to help you succeed.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened with my friend. And he's doing well, man.
That's awesome, dude.
Yeah.
That's really awesome.
Yeah.
And I feel like that, I can relate to that because... you know, and I know you can relate to what I'm about to say, in that when you're in the military, everyone is your brother.
Yes.
Your unit, like, these are guys that you'll literally die for.
Exactly.
And you know they'll die for you.
Yeah.
And that's the most, short of like perhaps your child.
Yeah.
Or your spouse, or maybe your parent. There's not a bond that's stronger than that.
Correct. That's an absolutely true statement.
And then you get out and it's gone.
Yeah.
Right? Not literally like those guys disappear, but effectively some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
There's guys I never spoke to again.
Yeah.
After the day I got out. And, yeah. But you're out, and when you were in the mill, you were somebody.
Yeah.
You had a grade or a rank.
Yeah.
A billet. Maybe, you know, I was at a recon battalion. You know, you could be a team leader, sniper. You have a specialty, radio operator.
Yeah.
Whatever. And then you get out and you're just nobody.
Yeah.
Or the perception is that purpose is gone. And those guys that were so invested in your success are not there anymore. And I think that a lot of guys struggle with that. I definitely did. And I think for our viewers that are not veterans, a lot of them can relate because they never had that bond.
Yeah.
They've never had it before.
Yeah.
And I'm not worried about the guy that has one friend. I'm worried about the guy that has no friends.
Yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And I don't believe in pity, but let's just say I empathize with the guys that are lost.
Yeah.
And we get those guys that like in our community,
yeah,
with the long hairs.
Yeah.
And I'm so, every time I see it, I'm so thankful, dude.
Yeah.
And you could just, they're so invested in us and they finally found a pack.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, dude, yes,
it's a beautiful thing.
You're with us now.
It is a beautiful thing, man.
It's beautiful, dude.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful to belong. And I don't believe in this like Sigma male lone wolf. I think lone wolf is the one of the biggest fucking lies I've ever heard in my life.
Mm-hmm.
No one's a lone wolf.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think a lone wolf wants to be a lone wolf?
No, probably not.
In the wild, a lone wolf lost their pack.
Yeah. And there's a reason, right? Maybe.
There could be a number, yeah, of reasons. You don't want to be the lone wolf.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you're the most badass. For some people, they're alone because no one can fucking stand them. Do you want to be that guy?
Yeah. No, I don't. But
Or they're alone because they lost everyone.
Yeah.
It's not always a good reason.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, well, you know, I'm kind of a loner. And I'm kind of a loner. But then I open your text messages and you have like 7 conversations going.
Yeah.
You're not a loner.
Yeah.
And you should not idolize loners.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to say that they're instantly bad people. But yeah, we're tribal creatures.
Yeah.
You'll find anything to belong to.
Oh, yeah.
It could be my favorite video game is Fortnite. I hope you have better hobbies than that, but that's your tribe.
Yeah.
You're a Fortnite guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jiu-jitsu. Oh, yeah. I am obsessed with Formula One.
Okay.
Racing.
Yeah.
Obsessed. Like, I have a sickness. That's, and I'll dope, talk about F1 for 7 straight hours.
That's dope.
And if I see, like, the other day, this is actually not the other day, it was a little while ago, but I was driving home from visiting a friend up in Central California.
Okay.
And I stopped at that rest stop right by Las Pulgas.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a dude that had the Red Bull F1 hat, the Sergio Perez hat.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite driver.
Okay.
Instantly. I don't know. I didn't even ask his name. Never saw him again. But yeah, I was like, but it was a Saturday, which means that's when they qualify for the race.
Yeah.
And Perez had qualified first. It's called pole, right? He qualified pole. And I saw this dude with the Checo hat. His nickname's Checo Perez.
Okay.
And I was like, dude, did you watch that quali? And he looked at me. I didn't say, hey, what's your name? My name's Jose. I live here and I'm about this and this is my life story. I just said, hey, dude, did you watch quali? And he looked at me and he went, fucking awesome, man.
Yeah.
Like that. He just instantly, and we had kinship.
Yeah.
And that's how easy it is to find a friend.
Yeah.
Right?
That's rad.
I never saw that guy again. So, of course, we didn't become friends. But the point is,
yeah,
in that moment, we shared that companionship, yeah, for 30 seconds.
Yeah.
That's how easy it is to relate to someone, right?
Yeah.
And so, I don't like when people say like, I don't need friends or I'm just a loner. And it's like, yeah, but how much have you tried, dude?
Yeah.
You know, maybe you just haven't found the thing yet, but you, yeah, should not be alone.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Right. Yeah. And, like our species literally cannot survive if we have nothing but loners.
Yeah.
That in itself is all the evidence you need.
Yeah.
Right.
Definitely.
So where did jiu-jitsu come in?
Okay, so got out of the military, was working. I gained a little bit of weight when I got out because obviously you're not PTing or, mm-hmm, you know, doing all what you, oh, need to,
trust
do,
me,
right?
I got my freshman 50 going after I got out.
Yeah, so I think everyone, after they get out, that, yeah, kind of happens, right? So what I was doing was working and stuff like that, and my son, I think he was maybe like 10 or 11 at the time, he unfortunately was getting bullied at school, and... we said, okay, well, let's look online and see what the best self-defense martial art is. So we did that. And it was jiu-jitsu, Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And there was, okay, there's one over here in Kearney Mesa. Let's take him there. So he was doing it. And I was just the parent that would bring him and sit on the sidelines and watch. So for literally 2 years, I'm sitting watching my kid train jiu-jitsu. And the coaches that are there, a guy named Johnny Faria and Zach Maxwell, they were saying, hey, why don't you come train? And I'm like, man, look at me, dude. Like, I'm overweight. My knees are busted.
Oh, yeah.
This and that, right? Yeah. You know, every excuse in the book. Until I had a guy, he said, well, here, let's just do a little bit of training, light training. You know, maybe you can get into it. And so from that point on, I was hooked, like literally hook, line, and sinker.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I started training. So my son, he actually quit after his third year training.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, he did his school thing, and you know, it's all good, but I still continued on. And so that's how I got into it. And we can kind of segue back into that brotherhood thing of, hey, like, to me now, this is that new brotherhood where it's like you have people that are willing to die for you and help you and do anything for you and want to see you succeed. And I was like, it was one of those kind of moments where it was just like the light bulb had went off and it was like, whoa, wait a second. This is like being in the military again, because there's a standard, there's a regiment, there's discipline. And we all have to be like that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, if I eat crappy today, that means tomorrow I'm not going to feel good to train and then I'm going to get my ass whooped. Well, in jiu-jitsu, you get your ass whooped more than you do the ass whipping.
It's a very humbling, I've heard.
Yeah. And it's like, man, like, yeah, it's a difficult sport. Mm-hmm. It's a rewarding sport though. And everyone has their journey, mm-hmm. right? Everyone has their path on how to get their black belt. Cause in the end, that's the ultimate goal, is sure. your black belt. But it's not really about the destination when it comes to that. It's about the journey. It's about the meeting of all these amazing people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you after, so example, after we're done training, we usually go get a beer after, and that our time to decompress and talk,
sure.
talk about technique, talk about this, talk about that. And, but there's that camaraderie. A lot of guys miss that when they get out of the service,
right.
They don't have that camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, you know, I tried to start up a nonprofit. A good friend of mine who is a EOD tech, a guy named Damon Jungerman. He's, on the East Coast down in Florida, but he was a Navy EOD guy. Him and I tried to start up a nonprofit. And basically what it was we'll identify a veteran. If they have issues with PTSD or whatever, what we were going to do is find what type of martial art he or she wanted to practice. And the donations that we received, we were going to pay for a year of training for wow. this vet. And that way that vet could still see, hey, like, okay, we still have this camaraderie.
Right.
Like, I found it. Like, these guys care about me. Mm-hmm. These guys want to talk to me. And that would help that person.
Sure.
And it might be cliche to say, oh, you know, jiu-jitsu saved my life or whatever, you know, but it, you know, it kind of did. And, again, I don't knock any other martial art as long as you understand that the discipline. And for me, it was just jiu-jitsu. That's what did it. It can be taekwondo, judo. It doesn't matter. As long as you know that there's a camaraderie and you got guys or gals that are mm-hmm. looking out for you and want to help you and see you succeed.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's awesome, dude.
Yeah, man.
I've always wanted to try, like, take a few classes as in like I'll be good after like two classes. Yeah. Of course not, right?
Yeah.
But you know what's interesting is I always felt like my injuries would like be prohibitive.
So that initially that's what I thought when I started training. Really? But the thing is when you get to start to know the guys at the gym uh-huh. and they say, oh, is your knee bothering you? Is your arm or whatever? And guys know that and guys are cognizant.
Uh-huh.
So when you're sparring, they won't do a thing like that. Cause I always do that. And uh-huh. then, you know, it's professional etiquette as well.
Sure.
Cause you know, everyone has jobs.
Yeah. Like no one's there to hurt you. Like yeah. everyone's there to train.
That's
like,
exactly yeah. it. Yeah. And you know, you still get these, you know, dickhead guys at the gym.
That's going to happen everywhere.
Bro, they get weeded out, dude.
Fast.
Really quick, okay. man. And they know it when they're not welcome there. And they already know like, hey, like this guy is doing this and he's doing this and hurting people. And so they kind of get shunned from the group and then they eventually get the message and then they eventually kind of exit out. You know uh-huh. what I mean? But yeah, there are guys that are injured and people know it. And it's like, hey, like I will take care of you because you're my brother, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to hurt you. We're all on the same team.
Yeah, the objective here is not to hurt each other. Yeah. You know, even like if you're watching a professional fight,
yeah,
the guys aren't there to like hurt each other.
Yeah,
the injuries are the byproduct,
correct,
of the match.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. like even on that extreme level where there's blood everywhere, like
yeah.
they didn't show up like I want to hurt this guy. It's yeah. like, I don't know, it's a physical chess match.
Exactly. 3D you know? Chess.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they say. Yeah, so the whole jiu-jitsu thing, man, it's very humbling.
Okay.
Probably.
So I have to ask one hair question, yes, at sir. Least, right? what do you do with your hair? And like, does it ever get in the way? Because obviously jiu-jitsu is like extremely physical.
Yeah, yeah. So this is taken from the cue of one of my main instructors. Her name's Leticia Hibero, female. The way she keeps her hair, I just follow exactly what she does.
Okay.
And normally what I'll do is I'll kind of wrap it. I'll usually use two hair ties.
Can you, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Can you do it live right now? Can you demonstrate?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that'd be dope.
Okay. Yeah. So normally this is how I do this. So I'll get my hair and I'll put it up, but I'll make sure that I do not put the actual bun part in the back here, because you're always on your back.
Yeah.
So if you're on your back, that thing is going to get in the way. So what I'll normally do is I'll kind of put it up like this. We're going to do a very center kind of a top knot, where usually you got to have two, but then you would just kind of wrap it like so. And then you would use your second hair tie and then
here you go.
And do that. So we do this and then basically just tie the crap out of it to it's where it's just
okay.
Boom, pulled straight back. And then it's out of the way.
Okay, yeah, I do something similar when I exercise.
Yeah.
And the goal is to, like, I mean, obviously I don't, I'm not a jiu-jitsu player, but, like, the type of exercise I do is very, like, there's rigorous. A lot of movement. Yeah. It's not static like powerlifting or bodybuilding. So the goal for me is to, like, not let my hair bounce.
Yep.
Because the more it bounces, the more it's going to, like, thankfully these hair ties are very good even with bouncing.
Amazing.
But, like, the goal is to, like, I don't want this thing to move.
Yeah.
Because then it's going to eventually work its way out.
Yeah.
You know, that's really interesting. And you don't, it's pretty good about not falling out even when you're rolling around.
Yeah. Man, I spar pretty hard, man. We often get after it. And I'd say maybe once in a blue moon, it will kind of get undone. Mm-hmm. That's if I'm, like, battling out with, like, some random black belts. But yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it's inevitable eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
but here's the thing. The follow-up, the hair care after is huge. Because you should always wash your hair after you're done training.
Uh-huh.
There's so much shit on the mat, MRSA, staff. It can...
Sweat, just
everything. Yeah, it's nasty, man.
You know, yeah.
I always make it a point, man. I always have to take a shower after I'm done training.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big... You know, it's huge for me. And even though, like, I know that, you know, you shouldn't really be washing your actual hair, like, every single day.
But you have to.
Yeah.
Especially in that environment, like, if you're going to be rolling, you're washing your hair
after.
Yeah,
you have to, because you got to get all that nastiness. And
that definitely poses unique challenges with your hair health, because that much washing is actually detrimental to your hair.
Exactly.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. So normally after that, like, if I have, like, a good solid week of training, I'll put, like, a mask on for my hair, or something like a, you know, if it's really hard, you know, I'll use the clarifying shampoo, but, you know, probably about once a month though, just to get all the junk out and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Just detox your scalp.
Yeah. Totally.
And do you do a lot of conditioning then, just try to help with all the washing?
Yeah. So normally what I'll do is I'll use a leave-in conditioner. More specifically, the one you guys...
Hell yeah.
Yeah, no plug there. but that stuff is amazing. Right, I mean, you guys... That. Yeah, wash your hair. Use the shampoo and conditioner, you know, at least sulfate-free. But if not, at least, you know, support the long hairs, which are local. And, you know, new company. It's just, you know, relatively new, but...
Yeah, we're not a dynasty.
Yeah, corporation. But, you know, this is just one of those things where it's like, hey... Like, these are products made for, you know, for us, for men and guys that have long hair. And it also is good for you, you know, as you're cleaning your hair out and you're not, you know, bringing MRSA and staph infection home to your family.
That is some, I've seen one person that got MRSA on their foot and it was horrifying.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
Yeah, that's.
You did not want to mess with that.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, man.
Dang, man. Dude, I feel like this show could go for another.
Yeah, dude, I wanted to talk about UFOs, paranormal.
We'll have to do that on the next one, dude.
Yeah.
But damn, dude, you've lived many lives, I feel like. I mean, there's the sailor, I feel like, I mean, my grandpa was a sailor, right? So, of course, I'm a Marine, so I'm always going to, you know, I'm always going to have a little jab.
Yeah, that'll...
But to me, obviously, as a Marine, like, corpsmen are special human beings, you know? So I don't say sailor, I say corpsman.
Yeah.
To me, it's like, it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
So you were a corpsman, you've been a scholar, now you're a healthcare provider, and you're a family man, you're a jiu-jitsu player. Like, there's a lot in there, dude.
You know, that in retrospect, I think about it.
Well,
yeah.
There's a guy named Jason Wilson. Okay. God, I hope I don't. I know his last name is Wilson. I hope I don't butcher that. But he has this thing about like comprehensive manhood.
Yeah.
And part of that is not to like boast your accomplishments, but to embrace them.
Okay.
You have to love yourself first, right? You can't love someone more than you love yourself.
Yeah.
You can love them as much as you love yourself. But so part of that is like, you know what? I'm not going to walk around sticking my chest out and saying I've done all this stuff, but
yeah.
I do need to appreciate and embrace the fact that I am the one that accomplished that. That's what I'm capable of. Now, let me show you what I'm going to do next.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you did those things, man. And as men, you know, we're kind of taught to be like humble and hopefully.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times guys will like deflect compliments, but it's like, no, like you need to own that, dude. You did all those things.
Yeah.
And you know what, man, a lot of those things were choices.
Yeah.
And you made the choice to be this person.
Yeah.
And so you should be definitely be proud of all those things, man.
Well, I appreciate it, man.
There are guys that, dude, their whole life will go by and on their deathbed, it'll be nothing but regret.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
And so I always tell, like, especially my friends, I'll give them compliments. Like my best friend recent, like about a year ago, he made a huge achievement.
Yeah.
And I just send him all kinds. He lives abroad now, so I couldn't just like say this in person.
Yeah.
And I paid him all these compliments, and then he was just like, oh, thanks, man. Like, you know, and I was like, no. You're my best friend, bro. Like, I know you.
Yeah.
What you're about to deflect everything I'm saying. And I said, you need to own this shit.
Yeah.
You did this.
Yeah.
Right. And don't deflect it. It's important, dude.
Yeah.
You got to be proud of that shit.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, dude, you've had you've had many lives, and you have many to come.
Appreciate right? it. Yeah.
So, yeah. And I hope we do this again, dude.
Yeah, dude. I think and we will.
I think I'm gonna have to hit you up. I finally need to.
Yeah.
Go get humble. I mean, hopefully I'm already humble. But I think I need to be like the boot again and get the shit kicked out of me on the mat.
Yeah.
Right on, man.
We do.
Well, thanks for stopping by, dude. This is awesome.
Yeah, thank you for having me, man.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely.
And I'm glad you like the products.
Yeah,
and
dude, totally.
And I think we're going to have you on again, dude. There's just too much to unpack.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd come back anytime.
Okay. Yeah, dude, awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, thanks for tuning in. And we'll see you on the next one.
See.